Hi, I'm Vernon Trollier for Optometry Times, and this is 10 questions for Paul and Adam Farkas, founders of CEWire and ODWire.org.
Paul, where did you grow up?
Oh, a long, long time ago. I grew up in the South Bronx and the part of New York City. Mm-hmm. But I'm really a Bronx boy.
What did your parents do?
My parents, well, they were immigrants, mm-hmm. and my father was in the meat business. He had a retail butcher shop. My mother was a homemaker until the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and then she went out to work in the Catskill Mountains as a cook. She started out as a cook assistant, but then very quickly became the first cook, which ultimately became a fairly well-known Catskill resort place where she worked for many years. I was called the cook's son. As a seven-year-old, I was written into the contract. So for many years, for about three, 4 years, I went with my mother to the Catskill Mountains to just play around at the hotel while she did the cooking.
It was a seasonal resort up there at the time, right, if I'm remembering.
That was called the Jewish Alps.
Yes.
People went there for basically, in those days, people that lived in New York City had a week or two vacation, mm-hmm. and for 2 weeks they were king of the hill. They went there, and they were eating Olympic champs. As people stuff themselves on cruises today, that's exactly what they did in the Catskill Mountains. three meals a day. And ultimately, I ended up working in the Catskill Mountains as first as a busboy and then a waiter. That paid my way through optometry school.
Adam, same question for you. Where did you grow up?
Well, I guess fortunately or unfortunately, I grew up with Paul. He's my dad. So, first, I guess, 10, 11 years in the Bronx, and then Paul moved us out to suburbia on Long Island and to be close to his suburban practice out there. And so it was sort of as a child of the 70s and 80s, so I lived sort of the suburban lifestyle that you may imagine.
but he was most modest. Adam was a computer nerd from the time he was about 12 years old. About 12, when would you get your first computer?
Yeah, like 11 or 12.
11 or 12.
What was your first computer?
Very first one was a VIC 20, had a whopping 4K of memory. And it was an interesting little machine.
And we never need any more than 48K.
Exactly.
And when our practice started computerizing, Adam came in to bail us out because we had some computer experts that were going to help us, but they didn't help us. They almost destroyed us by trying to set up a computer system, and then they walked out on us. And Adam is a 13-14-year-old.
Yeah.
He came into the practice, and he straightened us out with the computer.
So this is actually an interesting thing. This was in the mid-80s, mm-hmm. maybe 1985. So they actually tried to create one of the first EHRs, and there was nothing off the shelf then that you could use. And so they did it from scratch using the primitive tools that were available to them.
Yep.
How did you get from med school to tech geek?
So I guess the path is long and circuitous. After I went to med school, did my internship and everything, and Michigan offered me a spot in their MBA program right after med school. This was in the 90s, and those programs were unusual. And so they said, why don't you come on back and do your full-time MBA? And I'm thinking about it, and I thought, this would be interesting. They're giving me the opportunity. I'm not going to pass it up. So went back, 2 years later, had my MBA, and trying to figure out what to do with it. And, obviously tech is a big part of my life. And so, moved on from there into doing some technology in medicine, particularly running software companies that have to do with tech in medicine. It's the rest, as they say, is history.
Back to you, Paul. How has optometry changed since you started practice?
There's an old French saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The only big difference is that we have vision care plans now that have just almost sucked the life out of private practitioners. To me, the vision care plans are like it's like a vampire, and they rise every day to give you to suck a little more blood, but they keep the private practitioner just alive enough that they can keep getting blood out of them.
This is being recorded, you know.
Well, that's fine.
Just saying.
What happened when I first went into practice, the AOA was a very powerful organization. The American Optometric Association was an organization that was more than just paying your dues. In those days, you had to practice in a certain way that the AOA deemed ethical. And in those days, you could not practice under an assumed name. In other words, you only practiced under your own name. An assumed name was unethical. If you had a downstairs location, there were no frames allowed in the window if you wanted to be an AOA member. And most important of all, there was no advertising. Mm-hmm. There was no advertising until the 1970s. Once the 1970s came along, it all changed. The AOA thought about allowing people in that did advertise and were more commercial. The big corporations came in and found that there was a great profit margin in frames. So big corporations such as Walmart came into the field, and the big box companies came in, and the rest is, so again, as Adam says, is history.
Here's one for both of you. Why is online CE important?
One of the key reasons that it's important is that over time, what you're seeing is the requirements for CE are going up, 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 right? Back in the olden days, you really didn't need that much of it, and it was kind of a joke. But over time, the states are requiring more CE. They're requiring sort of stricter requirements around CE, too, where you actually have to listen to what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the old days, I guess you'd go off to a ski lodge or something, and you'd go for 5 minutes of class, you'd ski the rest of the time, and you can claim your credits. It's different now. Where people, you know, really are taking CE seriously. And with the hour requirements going up, people are having a difficult time getting the hours that they need affordably. It's very challenging for them, or to go on site, or if you have a new practice, actually going somewhere and taking time away from the practice can be very damaging. Harmful.
To say nothing of the inconvenience of travel, air transportation is not a pleasure any longer. It's very expensive and it's time consuming. So CE is an idea whose time has come.
Yeah, I think you know, just like with anything else, right? The doing things online is just a matter of convenience, and obviously, when you do it online as well, you can do it cheaper, just because the overhead's lower.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can also do it, you know, in your own time for the most part.
Correct. Yeah. So that's the other great thing that people, at least, are telling us that they like about it, is that they can do it whenever they feel like it. I had one guy tell me he was watching the lectures on his cell phone while he was mowing his lawn. There you go.
But at the end of his lecture, he has to pass an exam, which is unlike in-person CE, where you can sit there. As an ex-speaker, I can tell you that one of the great pleasures giving a presentation was to watch people with big newspapers before iPads. They used to spread out big newspapers, and they were reading while I was trying to lecture. And that's if I'm lucky. Many of them were asleep. And yet, but they put that hour in, that 50-minute hour, and they got credit for it. At least now with state boards working up and allowing online CE, what's required is that they pass a quiz at the end of the hour for them to get CE credit. So you can at least be assured that they are absorbing the material.
And that they're engaged and have to be responsible for knowing it, too.
Yep.
Okay. Adam, what's it like working with your father?
Painful.
Now, that was me.
Painful. Painful. So here's the deal. So this morning we were actually shooting one of our ODY radio shows. Paul, you know, came over to my little studio here in the basement, and like 10 minutes before we're ready to go, we're ready to get started, the studio's set up, he dumps an entire large coffee.
I did not take a dump. I dumped coffee.
All over the floor. Like, This is actually, it's a microcosm of working with him, because, you know, it's like misadventures, we have them. And yeah, so.
Well, unfortunately, I don't know if you ever watched Larry David on on Curb Your Enthusiasm, but I am a prototype.
Yeah, so
I mean well, but I get into terrible trouble.
But, you know, working with him is interesting because of the generational issues that we have. When I try to implement anything technology-wise, mm-hmm. having to run it by him is a very important thing, because he can show me in a very real way where people might have difficulties.
Mm-hmm. I'm the low bar.
But, you know, it's nice having that sort of that built-in test unit, essentially, is what he is. And it's been very nice over the past decade to have him there in that role, because it allows us to rapidly evolve what we're doing and learn what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, that's great to have, you know, somebody that you can literally throw the ball against and see how well it bounces.
Yeah, and I mean, he's not afraid to speak his mind, which is the important thing, too. A lot of times people are a little bit afraid to tell, you know, really let what they think, but like he's not afraid of that. No, for sure.
Much to my chagrin.
Yeah. Nothing like blunt quality assurance there.
Yes.
Both of you, what do you do for downtime?
Downtime. Well, I have no more downtime because I have a 7-year-old at home, so my downtime is pretty much consumed by him and being with him and doing dad things these days.
My downtime is trying to keep myself alive, which means that our ODWIRE is all time-consuming. It's a 24/7 type of business, so I'm working starting at 7 in the morning, but I make certain that by 11 a.m. I'm out either taking a long walk, a 1-hour walk for 4 miles, mm-hmm. or 2 miles, not 4 miles, forget that, 2 miles, or I'm in the club swimming. A lot of downtime, I'm just trying to stay alive.
Right, and, you know, for downtime for me, you know, when we finally do adult things, we're very fortunate to live in Portland, Oregon, which has a very large wine country just to the south, and so, you know, we can easily make day trips out into the wine country and go wine tasting and stuff like that. So it's a Portland itself has become a place for eaters. So it's if you're big into food, this is the place to be. So eating, you know, from one end of the town to the other, I guess, is something that we do a lot of.
Sounds lovely. Paul, how did Senior Doc morph into ODWIRE?
Oh, that again is a long story. In the early days, before Senior Doc and before DVDs and CDs, there was something called cassette tape.
Yes.
And in the 1970s, the early 70s, I decided to try to get some of the practitioners that were older than me to start having something called the Round Robin Group, where each of us would get on the cassette tape, say our piece for about a half hour or so, and move the tape on around the country. So there were about 8 fairly well-known optometrists around the country where this was our therapy session. We would just talk into the microphone for a half an hour or so, talking about clinical items, practice management topics, optometric politics, and it would go round and round, mm-hmm. and then, but finally the practitioners got started aging, as again they were at least 10 years my senior, and the topics started changing from clinical things and practice management things to aches and pains, mm-hmm. and medical things. So I felt like I was sitting in a swimming pool in Florida, listening to old people talking about their aches and pains and injuries. Ultimately, the round robin ended about the year 2000. Adam was just about finished with his medical school and MBA training, and I asked him to put something together that would be very simple, because I said, Adam, I think there's something called the Internet that's starting, and I think that people should be able to communicate using the Internet, but the old guys will not have a clue what to do. So set up something that would be so easy to use that even a moron like myself can handle it. And so he did something, and we called it Senior Doc. And what I did was I started initially to communicate with some of the older practitioners, and older in those days for computers was over 50. Anyone in the year 2000 that was over 50 was relatively clueless about computers, especially in optometry. Mm-hmm. So we started using it there, but I just didn't get enough people to correspond to start posting, because I didn't realize that most people of my contemporaries never learned to type. We never learned to, you know, word process. So that when you went to high school, you didn't learn to type, because that was for the secretaries. It was very hard for the older people to do it. And I noticed that some of the younger people were coming on board, and they were taking over the taking over Senior Doc. And at that particular, I said, hey, you know, we got to change the name. So we said, what would be a good name? And it turned out to be OD Wire. Mm-hmm. And with Adam's great assistance in making it into something relatively easy to use, it became popular very quickly. It had the blueprint of the Round Robin Group, mm-hmm. in that we were talking about clinical things, we speak about political things, and there is even stuff for personal things to discuss. So that's what OD Wire is all about.
We've got OD's own Facebook and OD Wire. Why are online forums important to the profession?
Well, I mean, I think they are very much a supplement or even a replacement for face-to-face contact, right? I mean, mm-hmm. most clinicians, you're in a dark room all day by yourself, right? I mean, if you think about just what people do on a daily basis, right, there's very little opportunity to actually meet with other people, to actually talk to other clinicians. So I think this is why it's very important to have that sort of outlet where you can bounce things off of people, you know, in a place that's sort of safe online.
Safe, and then there's no, you can talk about just about anything, provided you don't insult one another, and don't use foul language. And sometimes you say things that people in power should hear, but don't hear from others in power. So there's this freewheeling conversation without censorship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point, at least on our site. And, you know, other sites have different philosophies. But for us, the idea that, you know, you can talk about anything is very important. The idea that, you know, if you see something that is a terrible idea that's being implemented, you should be able to talk about it, at least in, you know, in a civilized way. And a lot of times people don't, or they can't, right, because they might only see each other two or three times a year at these conferences. So if something bad is happening, you might not actually be able to articulate what's going on except for a few times a year. Whereas, you know, something like this, you're in constant contact and can nip problems in the bud before they take hold.
And also the value of immediacy. You're being in print media, it can take a couple of weeks lead time till something will get on into print. Whereas if you're doing something online, it's within seconds, mm-hmm. if there's a problem.
If you could rebuild OD Wire from scratch right now, knowing what you do today, what would you change?
What would I change about it?
Why would you change the infrastructure now?
Yeah, so actually it's an interesting point. So OD Wire itself, infrastructure-wise, has been rewritten, I guess, three or four times. There have been three or four major rewrites, because the issue is you can't just do the same thing over and over again, because technology changes. And about every three or four years, give or take, we get that itch where we have to evolve the site to make it better. So, for instance, you know, when we first started out, the idea of mobile computing wasn't even real. You know, tablets were not a thing, phones were not a thing, but all of a sudden they became a thing. And when you get these paradigm shifts like that, we constantly have to re-engineer the site. In fact, where there's one going on right now, as a matter of fact, I don't know if that's going to be done. But it's a constant evolution, a constant blowing it up and trying again. So that's from the technical side. I'm not so sure what I would do differently, you know, sort of from the community side of things. Mm-hmm. We're kind of different in that we're very private. You know, one of our hooks is that everyone who's there is an OD, and they get vetted by Paul before they're allowed in, for better or worse.
Yes, thank you, Paul.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, that's right, you're still on, aren't you?
So you can see Paul's like the crazy old guy with the shotgun on the porch. Like, he guards the place. But it's, and it just makes for a very sort of different environment because it's so private. So I'm not sure what I would do differently. I suppose one thing that I would do differently is, you know, probably work with our users a little more closely to see exactly what they want. You know, Steve Jobs had a very famous saying that users don't know what they want. You have to show it to them. And to some extent, that's true. But I think these days, people are becoming much more savvy about what technology can do. And so listening to the users of the site and evolving it based on their input is something that we're doing a lot more now.
And the other thing is we have the issue of a very, very large audience. So but this is Adam's area, but when you have 22,000 people, you can blow up stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. So that's something that I would change. There we go. So, you know, you want to talk about a daily hassle. If I had to do it all over again, I think what I would probably do is split moderation duties and get more people to moderate versus just Paul and myself.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, it's something that it almost becomes second nature. You're on there all the time moderating stuff. However, if I had to do it all over again, I would have broken it out. I would have gotten different moderators for different parts of the site and let them run with each one of their own sections.
Yeah, but the difficulty is there, are you going to pay the moderators or are they going to do it on a voluntary basis? Unfortunately, people that volunteer are gung-ho the first week. But can you expect them to be monitoring the thing 24/7 on a volunteer basis? So if you start paying them, you got to start monetizing.
Hey.
Start monetizing, well, you know the story.
Yeah, then it gets challenging. So, you know, these are sort of the day-to-day challenges that I guess we face with the site.
Those are some real good points, especially for moderators. I'm used to people, mainly millennials, who will step forward and they will moderate stuff and you know, if they're into it, they'll stick with it for years. But I don't know how that fits in with the demographic of professionals. It doesn't sound like it would be very likely, as you said.
It's hard. I mean, you know, there are a core group of super users on the site. There are about 19,000 ODs, and there are this core group who literally live on there. I don't even know when these guys sleep. To be honest with you, you know, because, you know, we can see here when people are using the site, and there are some folks who use it round the clock. Like, I almost want to have an intervention just to tell them to go to a sleep doctor or something, because they're constantly on here.
Yeah, and one of the challenges is that we're on the West Coast, and there's a lot of damage that can be done between the people that have to try to get through the night. There are some that don't sleep, and they use it, and then the ones that get up very early and start with the insults. So by the time we can get to it, there's a lot of damage that can be done, and that is an issue.
Yeah. So anyway, so moderation is probably one of the biggest challenges that we have on a daily basis. Balancing moderation with freedom of speech, which is a challenge. We almost always tend to come down on the freedom of speech side, but it can be challenging.
Well, that leads me right into the next question. How might OD Wire change in the future?
I got to learn some of the semantics. For example, right as we speak.
Uh-oh.
I'm not at a computer, so I'm not very good at using the iPhone to fix things. Somebody yelled, "Where's the moderator?" Somebody called another person a butthead.
Oh my God!
What the hell is a butthead?
There you go. So you know, I think one thing that Paul's addressing again, how it might change, moderation is probably going to change a bit. What we just need to do is find like-minded fellow travelers who are willing to come on. And moderate in the same style that we've done. Again, pro freedom of speech. At the same time, don't let members kill each other, insult each other. So, other changes that I think we're going to see a technical evolution, almost certainly. We're going to keep evolving it as tech changes. But where that's going to go, who the heck knows, right? You never can tell.
For both of you, what's one thing you would change about optometry as it stands now?
Change about optometry?
Yeah.
Well, I would if I would rule the world. There would probably be schools closed. I think we have about 20 optometry colleges now.
Oh boy.
I would close down half of them. But without a doubt, I would keep the university affiliated optometry schools, and the ones that can't make it financially, they'd go first. But certainly the newest optometry colleges have no business being in the education business. And I say business because they're not owned by optometrists. Many of them are owned by osteopathic physicians. And, you know, education is a hell of a business. What other business can you go into where you charge somebody for 4 years of education and maybe you're teaching them for 2 years? where they're, it's the last 2 years they're out on rotation into optometric offices where they are getting, they have to pay their tuition, but they're getting the education from optometrists who are not compensated in any way, shape, or form. So it's a very, very profitable business. So I would immediately close down schools. I would try to get the tuition to a reasonable rate, which means I would probably have to, in some way, shape, or form, set up some sort of scholarship from corporations that benefit from successful optometrists. They should be funding the school so these kids don't have to come out of school with a couple of $200,000 to $300,000 worth of debt. So that's for starters. Anything else?
way to make friends there, Dad.
Adam, what
yeah.
did you say?
Well, you know, I feel sort of privileged in the position that I'm in because I really get to see what people are talking about. And, you know, I go to all the trade shows, too, so I get to meet people. And I think one thing that I would change, and I hope I phrase this correctly because I'm not sure how this is going to come out. What I see from a lot of people is an inferiority complex. Is that fair?
Optometrists always felt inferior.
Okay, so
it's not new.
But and I can say this as someone who's a little bit,
and some are.
There you go. But I can say this as sort of a little bit of an outsider looking in. There's an inferiority complex that I think is unjustified in a lot of ways because what optometrists do, they actually do better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. Even better than ophthalmologists who would rather spend all their day in an OR cutting things, right? Because that's really what they're trained to do. And so I think, you know, that's one thing I would change, just the mindset. You know, this whole idea of inferiority is just wrong. And there's so much opportunity that I think a lot of people are unaware of, or they're unwilling to sort of put themselves out there and explore different ways of working. And it leads to, you know, some quiet desperation sometimes, at least from what I've seen.
Well, give me an example of where this inferiority comes from.
Oh, I would say it happens not only in optometry, it happens in podiatry, it happens in dentistry. You're not a real doctor unless you have an MD after your name. Many people don't consider that you are a real doctor, and including the real doctors, the MDs, because optometrists never bump into MDs in their training, whereas you know, they go from optometry school into some rotations. A few get into a hospital situation, but by and large, they are never exposed to hospital medicine, which means that other MDs never meet up with optometrists. So when it comes to referrals, it's natural for a primary care MD to refer to a colleague who is another MD, who is an ophthalmologist. This is one of the great complaints among optometrists. Ed, any thoughts about that? How many optometrists did you see in medical school?
Zero. Actually, almost zero. You know, they'd be isolated, you know, in the vision centers that we had at the university, but they would be, you know, off to the side.
Yeah, and also the optometry school isn't like medical school where you have a bond because of a trial by fire. How often have you did you sleep under a desk during your surgical rotation?
It happened a few times.
You know? So basically, the MD training is one where it's almost like a hazing, where you don't sleep for 72 hours and all that business.
Are you recommending this as part of your academic program when you shut down half the school? Are you going to also institute
yeah,
this
I
no
would
sleep?
Make it. I would make tough. Yeah, I would have superior people. Basically, these would be the toughest people and the brightest people, rather than get the people that are weaker. Tough.
Oh my God.
If I rule the world, if I were a dictator.
And thank God you're not. Good Lord.
ODs are learning to do a lot more things than just, you know, fit people for glasses and contact lenses. I mean, they have to know pharmaceuticals and interactions and things like that. Do you think that has an impact on this insecurity?
Well, you know,
they actually have to know more about what they're doing.
I think people – yeah, no, you're right. People have to keep up. I think that's the key. Like in the old days, you probably didn't have to do too much, you know, education and see, but now you have to keep up. But if you're willing to keep up and you're willing to work – we've seen it on OD Wire over and over again. If you're willing to put in the work, if you're willing to learn to do the new procedures, you know, if you're willing to use the amniotic membranes, you know, you're willing to do punctal plugs, you're willing to do these things, you can earn a good living. And you can do this better than just about anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the problem is how does the public learn about it? Basically, when somebody wakes up with a red eye, what happens? They either go to their primary care doctor or they'll go to an ER, but they would rarely think of going to their family optometrist for that red eye, because most don't associate pathology with optometry. Whose fault is that? Well, let me count the ways. But basically, I fault the public relations department of the American Optometric Association for not having enough public information about optometrists' abilities other than selling contact lenses and eyeglasses. So when you see the optometrist, you associate eyewear, not necessarily medical eye care.
Optometric advocacy should be a lot more aggressive than it is now, then.
In my opinion.
I think it makes economic sense as well, right? There's no cheaper way to treat a red eye, right, than to send it off to an OD. The fact that anyone even considers going to urgent care or an ER, it's a real indictment of what's going on.
And the fact is that they won't get cured.
No, it's the worst place to go.
Okay, Paul, do you have any regrets?
About?
Well... spilling coffee on the floor.
Well, let's see.
He definitely should regret that.
No, I mean, you
should we go through life or just... Everybody has regrets. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look back at your life, everyone has crossroads, and everyone says, I coulda, woulda, shoulda. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, maybe I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have bought 141 acres of beachland in Grenada. In the 1960s, which was occupied.
Bad idea.
It was a bad idea. Offshore drilling in Israel, not such a good idea.
Bad idea.
So life goes through, but you know, you got to keep getting up to bat, or you're not going to hit the home run. So you keep getting up to bat, and you get a few winners, you get a lot of losers, but overall, I can't say I've had too many regrets.
Okay. Last question for both of you. And Adam, you're going to go first. What's the craziest thing you've ever done?
What is the crazy? I'm not a particularly crazy person by nature. Work with my dad on OD Wire. I mean, I think
probably.
Now that I think about it.
If you're suicidal. That's
yeah, great. I mean, yeah. So I think, honestly, I think this is the craziest thing I ever did was actually undertake this project.
And make it into a full-time occupation.
Yeah,
don't forget, Adam has tremendous credentials, and he's very modest, but he could with an MD and an MBA, he could do most anything, you know. But he chose
this thing is ruling my life now. So yes, that was the craziest thing. It was a disaster, and yes, there you go.
so
working with my dad, craziest thing I've ever done.
So there we have it.
Paul, same question.
Oh, I don't know. I've done so many crazy things in business, mm-hmm. For sure. Let me think just personally. I once with one, you know, I'm the youngest in my family, so I have nephews that are almost my age. And once I went with my nephew on something called a windjammer cruise to the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. Got time off from my wife and kids, and he got from his. And we went on a windjammer cruise, and he egged me on to do deep sea scuba diving, deep sea scuba diving. And I'm a fairly good swimmer, but so after a few minor lessons on this windjammer cruise, I found myself in the middle of the Caribbean, and everyone was jumping off the goddamn boat. They were jumping off the boat, and you know, because they all did it before, and there I was, and I went off the boat, and I sunk like a rock, and I went down, and I kept looking around, and I could my mask came off, and I had trouble breathing, and I did a very quick risk benefit, and I said, "Well, the benefit here, I may see some fish, but the risk is I can die." So I jumped out of the water. I said, "Get me out of here." And that was the last time I attempted scuba diving. One. You didn't know that story.
Vernon, good luck editing this. I wish you well.
Paul and Adam, this has just been absolutely fun. Great talking with you.
Well, we'll be curious to see what comes out of this. Listen, do you really need a picture of us?
Well, let me know if you need any henchmen when you take over the world, Emperor Paul. we'll talk to you sometime again.
Right. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much. This is fun.
Bye.
Bye-bye.